Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayigash with Rabbi David Levenkreuz. Rabbi Levenkreuz is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as a director of special programs for Pardes. And now, Rabbi David Levenkreuz.
Thank you, Larry. And this week's podcast begins with a spoiler alert. If you have not yet seen the new Pixar movie, Good Dinosaur, and don't want to know what happens at the end, please do not listen to this podcast or jump a few minutes. Basically, The Good Dinosaur is a charming story of a dinosaur and a critter who are separated from their families and reunited with their families in the end. The critter believes that all his family is dead, but this is in fact not so. And at the end of the movie, we have the very, very poignant meeting, and the pathos came out even in this, which was basically a child's movie. The pathos came out of what does it mean when somebody meets family that they thought were not alive. This is an extremely powerful trope amongst people who have lost family. It is a powerful part of our culture, of dreams, of psychology, this belief that maybe I will see the person again, maybe it was a mistake, maybe I misunderstood, maybe, all different types of conjectures. And the fact of the matter is that the reunion between Joseph and his father Jacob in this week's parasha is very, very much typical of this genre. It may even be the story has become so much a part of our culture that it may not just be an expression of this desire, but actually the cause at the back of everybody's mind, if they've lost somebody, chas v'shalom, is the idea that Jacob got to see his son after all. Maybe, who knows, maybe. And what happened when Joseph and Jacob met each other? Joseph is very excited. We read in Bereishit 46, first source in your source sheet, Joseph harnessed his chariot and he went to greet his father in Goshen. He's so excited, he doesn't wait for his father to come. He rushes out to meet his father. And then it says, Vayara lav. And he was seen to him. He presented himself. Vayipol al savarav. And he fell on his neck, Vayefk al Tzavarav, and he cried on his neck. Vayomeg Yisrael, and Israel says, Amuta hapam, now I can die, acharei re'oti et panecha, because now that I've seen you, ki odcha chai, because you are still living. A powerful, strong, sad, passionate meeting. Yisrael, Jacob says, now I can die. But what is really, really fascinating, and from the principle of, from the point of exegesis, is a certain vagueness of this. Who presents whose self? Who embraces who around the neck? Who weeps on his neck for a long time? It's all pronouns, and it's not clear whether it's Joseph crying or whether it's Jacob crying. What we're going to do together today is we're going to try and examine which one was it that was crying, and how this can help us understand what is going on in this reunion story. The vast, vast, vast majority of commentators that I found at any rate say that it was Joseph who cried. And in fact, grammatically, this is what fits. If you look again at the first one, Joseph, Vayal Yikrat Yosef Aviv Goshna, he's going to greet his father in Goshen, Vayar Alav, and he presented himself to him. It makes sense, according to the context, that this would be Joseph, who is, from a linguistic viewpoint, we're talking about Joseph, it would make sense that the pronoun would continue to be Joseph. If from a meaning viewpoint, it would make sense that Joseph presented himself to his father in the context of the story. And Rashi picks up on this and says, Joseph wept greatly and continuously. But Jacob, however, did not fall upon his neck, nor did he kiss him, For as the sages say, he quotes a midrash, Shehaya kore et shma. He was reading the Shema. This never ever ceases to amaze me. Here we have one of the greatest reunions in the history of the world, maybe. And, well, what happens? Does Jacob's son, he says, pardon, son, haven't seen you for many years. Delighted to see you. Oops, I have to say the Shema. And that is, in fact, one idea, that the time came to say Shema. He was a good from Jew. Therefore, he said the Shema. But there is... it could be read more deeply or less facetiously, shall we say, than that. One is that the Shema is about submission to God. And what Jacob is saying is, I'm in a strange land now. I've got my son again. I could be led to have faith in myself or to be puffed up. I could be drawn away into the attractions of the land of Egypt. I'm going to submit to God in a strange land. He could be thanking God the way that Jacob knows best, very different from the first one, which is more formalistic. What do I, Jacob, a frum yid, what do I know? The way that I thank God is through the Shema. Perhaps most intriguingly, and most of the ideas I'm sharing today are ideas of students through the years when I've taught this, most intriguingly is that one says the Shema before one dies. And what Jacob says is, Amoti hapa'am, now I can die. He might feel his life has come to its fulfillment, it's come to its end. He's going to say the Shema because he dies. Fascinating, and of course it's a complete anachronism, the idea that Jacob would be saying the Shema. But the Shema says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And of course, Jacob is Israel. And there could be something very, very powerful about Jacob reminding himself with this prayer about who he is and what is important to him. So just this little discussion about the Shema gives us many, many different ideas of Jacob. As a halachic formalist, as somebody who is aware of the difficulties of keeping Judaism going in a foreign country, of somebody who thanks God, about somebody about to die, who says the Shema, about somebody reminding himself who he is. Whatever it is, even though Jacob is showing a lot of emotion in this these interpretations, it's Jacob who is the more composed one, and it's Joseph who is the more emotional one. Fascinatingly, for Samson Raphael Hirsch, even though he agrees that Joseph is the one who cries, for him, he comes to an opposite interpretation as to who is the more composed one, who is the more firm one, and who is the more emotional one. He writes, Joseph wept, Jacob did not weep. Jacob had finished weeping through all the years of Joseph's absence. Jacob had led a dull, monotonous life, weeping for Joseph. Weeping is what made Joseph who he was. He became a weeper for his son who was gone. And we know that this happens sadly so much, but understandably so much with people who lose somebody. It becomes their defining purpose. It becomes who they are. It becomes very, very strong for a family, God forbid, who loses a child, to be able to say this will not become our defining features. He says his whole life, Jacob has become a mourner. As opposed to this, Joseph has no time to... he said Joseph has an eventful life. He had no time to surrender so completely to the pain of separation from his father. He's absorbed in the presence. But now, finally, he feels the impact of the separation, and he says Jacob had already become Israel, but Joseph was still weeping. In other words, Jacob is the one who sadness has defined his life. Joseph is the one who's had an interesting, eventful, not always good, not always pleasant, but an interesting, eventful life, a proactive life. And now it's finally an outlet for another side. So at this moment, Jacob might be the stronger one, whereas Joseph is the more emotional one. But in general, Joseph is the one who's lived the proactive, the strong life, whereas Jacob is the one who has spent a life weeping. Rashi is echoed in Sana. He says the reunion of father and son is marked by mute embrace and copious tears. No words are exchanged, for none can be adequate. And this is a very, very powerful, important point, which we're going to come to in our conclusion. And that is that tears can do what words cannot do. They could have sat, they could have spoken, they could have talked, they could have shared. Nothing is quite as strong as that cry. We even speak in our Western culture of a good cry, or parting is such sweet sorrow, that there's something very, very powerful about a cry. He said only the sounds of Joseph's weeping pervade the silence. And in Alter, we have a very, very interesting theory. Alter writes, this is Robert Alter, the contemporary commentator, "We are invited to imagine a sobbing Joseph who embraces his father while the old man stares dry-eyed, perhaps even rigid, too overcome with feeling to know how to respond or to be able to respond spontaneously, until he finally speaks and says, 'I may die now after seeing your face, for you still are alive.'" Here we have Jacob being the more emotional one, but the more emotion is expressed dafka in him not being able to cry. He's beyond tears. He's in such shock. He's so overcome with feeling that he cannot even cry. And we have this also as a response to tragedy. Sometimes things are so terrible that people do not even cry. There was a not so many years ago, there was a pigua, a terror event in an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem. And whereas often there's screaming and shouting after an event, when people said after they went, there was terrible, terrible silence. People were just not speaking. It was like Aaron, who couldn't speak after the death of his sons, Vayidom Aharon. Over here, what Alter says is Jacob is even too sad or too emotional to even cry. And ironically, Joseph's crying is a sign of him actually being less emotional. Again, we're going to look at this in the conclusion, but it's very, very interesting that all of these seem to bring up some type of a dichotomy between a person who is more put together, more proactive, more in control, versus a person who lets loose more. It may be expressed in crying, it may be not expressed in crying. Different people express it in different ways. It might be the same action, but interpreted differently. But whatever it is, we have a dichotomy, if you will, between a more classically male type of approach, or a classically Britishy kind of approach of keeping things in a little more, versus a more emotional Eastern female, if you will, I know I'm talking in stereotypes, type of approach that is being presented over here. And of course, it's very, very fascinating. Joseph is often expressed in feminized terms as being beautiful, as being curling in his hair, whatever the case might be. So I think it's very, very interesting that we have this tension here going on between composure and expression of emotions. The Ramban, Nachmanides, is a classic commentator who says that it was not Joseph who cried, but rather Jacob. And in fact, while the grammar fits in more with it being Joseph, the fact of the matter is that sometimes subjects do shift. Many, many times in the Tanakh and in other places, or even when we speak, people will often say, you know, well, who do you mean by he? And you mean, no, I meant that one. And it's a person who one has spoken to earlier in the conversation. So there is a reason for the shift. He writes, "It is more natural to assume that the father wept over his son than the reverse. Who more easily sheds tears? It is well known whose tears are more present. The aged parent who finds his long lost son alive after having despaired and mourned for him, or the young son that rules." This is similar to what Samson Raphael Hirsch says of the prime minister of Egypt having led this very, very colorful life versus the father whose life has been defined by mourning. But over here, instead what we have is we have the one whose life has been defined by mourning as continuing to mourn and cry, whereas the one whose life has been defined by proactiveness and excitement continues in his way. It's the same psychological explanation, but a different expression for it. And in fact, there are many reasons it would make sense, perhaps, that Joseph would keep it all together. Perhaps he does not want to cry in front of his brothers. He doesn't want them, perhaps, to see how much they hurt him. It could also be that he wants to cry in front of his brothers and he wants them to see how much pain they've caused them. Either way, we have an example over here of a Jacob who feels amount of control, a Jacob who's being strategic, and a father crying perhaps for all the years that he lost out of giving to this child. There's another reason, I think, that Joseph may not cry, and that is that he was angry with his father. He blamed his father for favoring him, which put this whole cycle into place. In all his years as prime minister of Egypt, the viceroy, he never once sought out his father. Would it have been so hard to send a letter? Would it have been so hard to send a messenger to go and have a look, even if he couldn't go himself? Would it have been so hard for him to go himself? And had he done so, he would have seen his mother. And he lost out on so much. And I think there's a profound feeling at this moment of it could have been, might have been, should have been. And this is reinforced, this idea that after the scene that we're discussing today, Joseph abruptly starts talking about business. You'll live over here and I'll go speak to Egypt and we'll see what we can do about your finances. There seems to be unfinished business going on. And that is why I personally think it is both. That seems to me the most logical reason why the Torah left things so vague. Either because it was both, or because they wanted us to ask this question, which ultimately gives us the answer that both of them had good reason to cry. So why then could the Torah not say they? Why did it have to be he? Why could the Torah not just have said they? And I think the reason is that much of Genesis is about not making it. Esau and Jacob aren't really friends afterwards. Ishmael and Yitzhak, although they are together at their father's funeral, they never ever really make friends again. Here is one of the examples of something in the Torah where things do come right at the end, but even here, it's not really. There's pain left, there's unfinished business left, there's anger left, there's guilt left. And maybe what the Torah is doing over here is showing in its own subtle way that it isn't a complete reunion. Another idea that I think is brought on by the idea of both of them crying is whether we really need this dichotomy between firmness and emotion. I once read a manual, I think it was from the 1920s or the 1950s, I can't remember, a manual for managers of businesses, how to behave. And they said, you know, whatever you do, don't show any emotion. And if people are nasty to you, don't show that it affects you in any way. There's somehow this idea that either you're firm and in control or you're a basket case weeping. I think what we looked at today is there are ways to see Jacob as being a person who did his mourning and is now ready to move on. Joseph as somebody who is in control, and the opposite. Both of them as people giving in at this moment to emotions that are uncontrollable. And who says we can't be both? Who says that it's either or? Who says that those manuals from the 1950s are right or the 1920s? Or whatever it was, I think what all these different interpretations and the idea of it being both of them is saying a good human being needs to be composed at times, needs to hold back at times, and at times needs to give in to all the different emotions that might be going on. Why should it have to be either or? Another thing that Joseph and Jacob share, I dare say, is guilt. Joseph, guilt for not being in touch with his father, not letting his father know he's alive. And Jacob, I always wonder what Jacob knew and didn't know. He realized, it's hard for me to believe that he bought the story completely and didn't in some way know that he caused what had happened to his son. Perhaps he was guilty because he accepted Joseph's death at some point and hadn't carried on believing that he would come. Fascinatingly, in the movie The Good Dinosaur, when the little critter meets his family again, they don't cry. It's more the silence of the old man. Perhaps they felt it would be too much for kids to see the crying. But here they cry. In our story, they cry. And it's a crying that fixes up the relationship, that bridges the troubled waters. Fascinatingly, in the Ethiopian tradition, this reunion took place on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the day when God and people are reconciled, is also the day of Veheshiv Avot Al Banim, when fathers and sons and fathers are reunited. What's happening over here is tears are building a new connection, a renewed connection between Joseph and his father. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Levenkreuz. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.